Hello. Thank you for tuning in. You are listening to ByteRadio.me's Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. For network or show information, visit www.ByteRadio.me or call 843-808-0777. And now, the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show with your host, Robert Sharp. Good day, everyone, and thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Today, my very special guest is Dr. Glenn Livingston, and we will be talking about his book, Never Binge Again, Reprogram Yourself to Think Like a Permanently Thin Person. Dr. Livingston is a veteran psychologist and was the longtime CEO of a multi-million dollar consulting firm, which has serviced several Fortune 500 clients in the food industry. You may have seen his or his company's previous work, theories, and research in major periodicals like the New York Times, the LA Times, the Chicago Sun-Times, the New York Daily News, American Demographics, or you may have also seen him on ABC, WGN, and or CBS Radio. Disillusioned by what traditional psychology had to offer overweight or food-obsessed individuals, Dr. Livingston spent several decades researching the nature of binging and overeating via his work with his own patients and a self-funded research program with more than 40,000 participants. Most important, however, was his own personal journey out of obesity and food prison to a normal, healthy weight and much more lighthearted relationship with food. You can find out more about Dr. Livingston by visiting his website, which is neverbingeagain.com, and I do have a direct link to his website in the show page description. We do not have Dr. Livingston here at the moment, so let me go ahead and just take a quick break, and I'll play some music, and when we come back, hopefully we'll have, oh, there we do. And we have Hello. Dr. Livingston. Good afternoon, sir.
Oh, good afternoon. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
You're coming through loud and clear. Okay, I wasn't sure if I was. Well, I'm doing well, and thank you so much for having me on the call, and thank you for that lovely introduction.
Well, it's my pleasure, and, you know, this is going to be such a timely conversation. I'm glad we're having it. Before all of the holiday eating, or just as the holiday, you know, eating occurs. But I guess the first thing I wanted to kind of start with is if you wouldn't mind sharing a little bit with the listeners about your personal journey and kind of how it, you know, this topic became such an important one for you.
Well, I guess the most important thing for you to know is that I'm not just a psychologist that worked with eating disorders. As a matter of fact, I used to refer them out because I had such a serious problem myself. I struggled for 30 years on my own, starting from around 17 years old when I figured out that because I'm 6'4 and reasonably muscular, I could eat pretty much whatever I wanted to. And, you know, as long as I worked out for 2 or 3 hours a day, I'd be fine. And so I was having a pizza or two, not a slice or two, but a pizza or two, and boxes of donuts and boxes of muffins and boxes of chocolate bars, anything that you can imagine. And I thought it was great. I didn't think it was a problem. The only problem in retrospect was that I was spending an awful lot of time working out and an awful lot of time eating that I could have put into more productive use. But at 17 years old, that didn't really bother me. And I was thin. Mm-hmm. But fast forward until I'm 22, 23, and I'm in graduate school. I'm commuting 2 hours, 2.5 hours each way, and I'm married, and I've got responsibilities, and I've got patients. And I just didn't have the time. I couldn't work out 2 or 3 hours a day. I could barely work out 2 half hours a week. But I had started these patterns, and I was still very obsessed with food, and I couldn't stop eating. So I would be sitting with suicidal client, and I just couldn't be present. And anybody that really knows psychology knows that it's not really just an intellectual endeavor. It's something where you have to lend your client your soul. You really have to be emotionally there with them. Otherwise, they don't really care how much you know, because they don't know how much you care. And I couldn't be 100% there. And it was really, really important to me. I'm from a family of 17 therapists. And this is the most important thing in my life. And the standard joke is when something breaks in the house, nobody knows how to fix it, but everybody knows how to ask it how it feels. So, and you don't want to come to a family reunion. Yeah. So I was really disturbed, and I was getting fatter and fatter. And even though I'm 6'4", I was, pushing about 80 mm-hmm. pounds heavier, I think, because I stopped weighing myself at some point, but probably about 80 pounds heavier than I am now. And my triglycerides were 10 times what they should be. And the doctors were telling me that I'm going to die of a heart attack, probably in my early 30s, if I don't get this under control. Hmm. And so I did everything I could, all the things I knew how to do, which at the time were going to see all the best psychologists in New York, in and around New York City, which I knew because of my family, and going to Overeaters Anonymous, even taking medication with a psychiatrist for a while, and I just couldn't fix it. It would get a little better for a while, and then it would get a lot worse. And somewhere in there, I decided that, I don't have kids and I never commuted, so I was doing a lot of corporate consulting also. I had a lot of time. And they were paying me an awful lot of money to do these studies. And they were really big studies, and I figured, well, maybe these studies are worth something. So I did one for myself. And over the course of about 5 years, I collected 40,000 surveys back when the internet clicks were cheap. And I asked people what foods they struggled with, and I asked them about various areas of their life. And what I found was that people that struggled with chocolate, and all my binges started with chocolate, almost all of them, they tended to be lonely or brokenhearted. People who struggled with salty, crunchy things tend to be stressed at work, and people who struggled with bagels and bread and like soft, chewy things tended to be stressed at home. And I thought that was really interesting. But before I started working with clients about it, I figured I'd try to solve it myself. And I went straight to my mom because, she was not only a therapist, but she brought me up. And I said, Mom, I'm not in the world's best marriage. And so, of course, I'm a little lonely or brokenhearted. But why do you think I run to chocolate when I'm lonely or brokenhearted? Is there something in my upbringing that would have set that up? And she gets this look on her face and she says, I'm so sorry, honey. I'm just so sorry. And I said, what? And she said, well, I'm really embarrassed, but when you were about 1 year old, I was not in a good state of mind. My father had just come out of prison, and I have to tell you, he was guilty. And I idolized him my whole life. He was the only good figure in my life, and he was guilty, and I was just devastated. I was very, very depressed. At the same time, your father was a captain in the Army, and they were talking about sending him to Vietnam. And so I thought I was going to be a single mother with another, kid in the oven. And I was afraid that your father could die or he wasn't going to come back. And I hardly wanted to live at that time. And I didn't have the wherewithal to hug you and feed you and love you when you needed hugging and feeding and love. And so what I did is I put a little refrigerator on the floor, and I kept a big bottle of chocolate Bosco syrup in it all the time. And whenever you came over to me and you were upset or you wanted food or you wanted love or you were crying, I'd say, honey, Glenn, go get your Bosco. And you'd go crawling over to the refrigerator and you'd open it up and you'd take out the Bosco chocolate syrup and you'd suck on the bottle and you'd go into a chocolate sugar coma. And you'd think that that would be the moment that solved everything for me. I mean, if this were a movie, then at that moment, right? Like at that moment, I'd hug my mom, we'd have a good cry, and I'd never have trouble with chocolate again, right? But would you believe me if I told you that the problem got worse at that point? And it did. The reason it got worse, because there was this crazy voice in my head, like a voice of justification that said, you know what, Glenn, you're right. Your mama didn't love you enough. And she left a great big chocolate-sized hole in your heart. And until you can fill it with the love of your life, you're going to have to fill it with chocolate. So let's go get some right now. Yippee. And at that point, I kind of woke up and said, maybe I can't love myself thin. Maybe it's this crazy voice that's the problem and not the original traumas. And maybe these foods have a life of their own once they're in your system and this voice of justification is taking over. And I started to think about it more like a fire in a fireplace. And this voice of justification was poking holes in the fireplace so that the fire could burn down the house. And I started to believe that maybe if I could fix those holes, that was going to be a lot faster than putting out the fire. Because I knew as a psychotherapist, it takes 5 to 10 years of intensive therapy to, if you're successful at all, to really put out those kind of fires. Well, a couple of other things were going on at this time. I've been doing a bunch of consulting for Big Food. And I was very familiar with the engineered food-like substances they were putting into the market. Concentrations of starch and sugar and fat and oil and sodium and excitotoxins that were designed to hit your bliss point without giving you the nutrition that you needed to feel satisfied. I actually remember a major food bar manufacturer telling me, the vice president telling me that their biggest profitable insight was then they took the vitamins out of the bar because they were expensive and they didn't taste good. So took the nutrition out of the bar and they put the money into making it look healthy instead by packaging it in a diversity of colors and, you know, shininess. Because a shiny, right? Because a shiny diversity of colors, that in nature would signal a diversity of nutrients that were available. Okay? Like a, you know, there's a reason why we're attracted to a very colorful salad with yellow carrots and deep green lettuce and maybe some blueberries and purple cabbage on it. There's a reason we're attracted to that. It signals a diversity of nutrients that are available. But these companies were just making it appear like that. And then they were spending all this money on advertising. I mean, there are billions that go into advertising in the industry. And it's just intended to make you feel like you can't live without it, make you believe that it's healthy. Most people think advertising doesn't affect them, but it actually affects you more when you think that because your sales resistance is down. So I realized that, gee, maybe it's not what's eating me. Maybe it's actually what I'm eating. And simultaneously, I was coming out of Overeaters Anonymous, and I read a book called Rational Recovery by Jack Trimpe, and he works with alcoholics and drug addicts mostly in an alternative addiction treatment paradigm. He really believes that the seed of addiction is the reptilian brain, the most primitive, earliest part of our neuroanatomy. And that if that's true, and I believe it is from what I've seen, if that is true, then loving yourself more is not really going to cure you of an addiction because the reptilian brain doesn't know love. When the reptilian brain looks at something in the environment, it says, do I eat it? Do I mate with it? Or do I kill it? It's eat, mate, or kill. There's no love there.
Uh-huh. Okay.
It's like a drinking game, right? Eat, mate, or kill. And his approach with alcoholics is to have them dominate that part of their brain because our brains are wired for that. You know, our mammalian brain and our neocortex is dominant and superior to the brain stem and the lizard brain. It's more recently evolved and superior to it. It doesn't really matter. Some people say they don't believe in evolution. Well, okay, if God put it there, it's still set up like this. So
right.
I just like to head that argument off at the pass. So
I like your style.
But the point is that love is part of the higher brain. It's like in the mammalian brain, which says, before you eat, mate, or kill that thing, what impact is that going to have on our tribe and the people and things that we care about? Or the neocortex, which says, before you eat, mate, or kill that thing, how does this affect our long-term goals and strategies? What about our contribution to society or creativity or music or art or spirituality? What about the kind of person we want to be in the world? That's all in the higher part of the brain. And he says that, I'm really paraphrasing this, this is my interpretation, but he said that overcoming addiction involves dominating the reptilian brain, not loving it back to health. And it's very much like dominating any of your other biological organs. So, for example, I am the master of my testicles. I know that sounds like something a college kid would put on a t-shirt, but what I mean by that is that my testicles generate powerful biological urges, but I don't express them at random. I don't run up and kiss attractive women on the street. I'm the master of my bladder. My bladder generates powerful biological urges, but I don't pee in the middle of a business meeting. I wait until I can find an appropriate time and place and go in the bathroom to pee. I'm not afraid of my bladder. I'm not afraid of my testicles. There are things that I'm in charge of, much the same way that an alpha wolf is in charge of the pack. And when an alpha wolf is challenged for leadership by another member of the pack, that alpha wolf doesn't say, oh, poor baby, do you need a hug? That alpha wolf says, get back in line or I'll kill you. Like it asserts dominance, it asserts superiority, it shows leadership. And so this is the embarrassing part. I suddenly realized that I was going to have to change paradigms. Even though I was a psychologist from a family of 17 psychologists or psychotherapists, I had to engage in a game of ruthless domination, not in a game of love. And so this is what I did, and I never intended to publish it. I really thought this was going to be private, but it fixed me. I decided that my reptilian brain was going to be my inner pig. I was going to call it my inner pig. And I'm just talking about a mental construct that you could think of it as all of my destructive food thoughts. I'm not talking about real pigs in the world. I don't want you to be mean to real pigs in the world.
Right.
Well, some people misinterpret that.
I'm sure. But if they read the book, they'll understand.
Yeah. Then I decided that I was going to draw very clear, bright lines so I would know when I was eating healthy and when I wasn't. So, for example, I'd say, I'll only ever have chocolate on a Saturday again. Therefore, if I heard anything in my head that suggested I should have chocolate because, I don't know, I'd exercised hard enough and it wouldn't make a difference that day, or I could start again tomorrow, or maybe just because chocolate comes from a cocoa bean and that grows on a plant and therefore it's a vegetable, that voice was going to be my pig squealing. It was squealing for pig slop. And I don't eat pig slop, and I don't let farm animals tell me what to do. And as crazy and primitive and crude as that sounds, for a sophisticated psychologist like me, I don't eat pig slop, and I don't let farm animals tell me what to do, woke me up at the moment of impulse and gave me those few extra microseconds to remember who I was and how I wanted to be around those particular foods. And so that's what I did. And it wasn't a miracle. Well, it was in some ways, because it immediately restored my sense of hope and power. I'd been feeling powerless. I'd actually been taught to feel powerless in Overeaters Anonymous. I'd been feeling like I had no control over it. And I suddenly realized that I did have control. I didn't always make the right decision, but I no longer felt like there was some outside force that was controlling me. And gradually, as I realized that I did have control and I had hope and enthusiasm and I wasn't so depressed about the whole thing, I started to make the right choice. And over the course of a couple of months, I found that I was able to control myself with chocolate. Then I expanded it to other things, and I made other categories of different types of rules that you can make, and I experimented a lot. And I kept a journal for years and years and years of me versus my inner pig and all the crazy things it said and how I disempowered those thoughts. And I wasn't going to publish it, but a couple of years ago, I was a partner in a publishing company. I was a minor partner. And the CEO asked if I could write a book because they wanted to do a marketing experiment. And I said, well, I've got this crazy journal. And long story short, I published it with them. And it just took off. I mean, we've got 600,000 readers and 1,700 reviews and thousands of people writing in to say, I don't eat pig slop, and I don't let farm animals tell me what to do either. And that's my life now. So that's what I do, and I've got a whole business around that.
Well, that's great. Well, you know, there was just so much in that, you know, in your story that really goes again, and not goes again. It is contrary to a lot of the thoughts and beliefs when it comes to coping with overeating. And I mean, you know, that the idea is if you can find that root source, you know, the your mother and the Bosco, you know, that's gonna kind of do that aha moment, you know, problem solved. And now, when it comes to talking about overeating, there's overeating, there's all kinds, stress eating, emotional eating, binge eating. In the name of your book is Never Binge Again. So first of all, how would you describe what binge eating is?
Well, it's funny. I mean, I could give you the DSM-5 definition, or you could look it up for yourself, which has to do with the frequency of recurrence of eating to the point that you feel disgusted with yourself, you know, overly full. We have exaggerated a negative self-image that, you know, it happens so many times a month, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We could talk like that because people are trying to look for a black and white thing and say, am I a binge eater or am I not a binge eater? But the truth is, what's more important is whether you eat beyond the point of your own best judgment. If you eat beyond the point of your own best judgment, then you'd probably benefit from sitting back and thinking, well, what is my best judgment with this particular food? So if I overeat at restaurants, then what is my best judgment? Do I want to have one plate of food and one dessert? Or one plate of food and two desserts? I don't know. I don't tell anybody what to eat. I just help them define it and stick to it. And you'd benefit from having this structure of mind so that you can hear the voice of rationalization that talks you out of your best thinking over and over again, so you don't keep changing your mind. So you can actually, you know, make a plan and stick to it and move your eating from the realm of your impulse and emotion to the realm of your intellect so you can pursue all your health and fitness goals. So I don't think you have to be formally sick to use this program. I don't think you have to be a formal binge eater. I tend to attract people who have had that diagnosis because of the title of the book, but I don't think that's the case. I will tell you that I can't offer this book for treatment of any, you know, disorder, disease, or condition, and I can't diagnose, you know, treat or cure using this methodology because it's not something that I developed in concert with the best practices in my profession, although the research is starting to support the implementation of, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy for binge eating. It is starting to show that that's effective. I don't offer this as a treatment. I offer this as education only, just because of the legalities of it. I will also, I just want to say one more thing while we're talking about that, which is that there are people with bulimia who seem to be getting better with this. I didn't have bulimia. Maybe you could say I had exercise bulimia, but I never stuck my finger down my throat. And so this was not developed with that intention at all, even though some people are using it. Their number one rule seems to be I don't purge no matter what. And then if they can follow that, then they can begin to make other rules. I don't have much luck with this with people with anorexia. It doesn't seem to work with anorexia. So I just wanted to sort of say that up
front.
Good. I don't want to mislead.
No, that's perfect. You know, and reading the book, I mean, you're very upfront, you know, and you know, when it comes to basically creating a different perspective and awareness when it comes to eating and food, and you know, when is a, you know, what is a good food plan for you, you know, individual, and not provide a one size fits all kind of approach, because it seems that it really is an individual. The condition is so individualized, depending on the source of the eating, the belief system one has, and then the idea of one of the things that you talk in the book about is that that character trumps willpower, for so many people, they feel that if I only had the willpower, that would solve everything. So can you talk a little bit about, maybe the misbelief that willpower is the answer?
Yeah, willpower is a limited resource. There's a lot of research on willpower lately. And what we see is that it's not like a genetic gift that some people have and some people don't. It's more like gas in the tank. And what burns that gas is decision-making. And so there are only so many good decisions you can make over the course of the day. And unfortunately, this includes non-food decisions also. So we find that people have trouble resisting marshmallows more so if you make them do math problems first, because they had to make decisions about what answer was right. So doing your email, deciding do you, spam this or delegate it or delete it or defer it, that's a decision that burns your willpower. And this is why so many people have trouble eating when they get home at night, even if they're good all day. They exhaust their willpower and they're just done by the end of the day. What seems to restore it is self-care, sleeping, eating healthy, meditating, taking a decision-making break, taking a 5 or 10 minute walk outside where you can breathe and think without anybody or anything impinging upon you. That's what restores your willpower. However, character eliminates the need for decision making at all. So I'll give you an example. Let's say you walk into a diner, and as the waitress is sitting you down, you see there's a $10 bill on the table, and she didn't see it. She doesn't know the last customer left her a tip. And she says, I'll be right back. I just have to get you a menu. And there is nobody up front, and there are no windows, and there's no security camera, and nobody would see you take the $10 bill. Almost everyone I talk to in this situation says, well, there's no way I would take it. And I'll say, why? Nobody would know. And they'll say, well, because I'm not a thief, and that woman worked hard for her money. And I'll say, so as a matter of character, you have an unwritten rule for yourself, which is something like I never steal, that eliminates all decisions that you'll have to make in the face of temptation for this particular situation. And they would say yes. And say, well, why can't you do that with food? And it turns out that you can. So what I'm really saying when I say that I'll only ever have chocolate on Saturdays again, what I'm really saying is I'm not the kind of person who eats chocolate during the week, or I'm becoming the kind of person who doesn't eat chocolate during the week. I'm defining who I am with regards to that particular temptation so that I won't have to make decisions and I can preserve my willpower for more important things. People are integrating these types of I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say that's that I just haven't thought about it that way. it makes following a plan easier.
It makes it a lot easier so that you're not impinged upon by all these food decisions all day long. And it turns out that we are building these rules of character without even knowing it all the time. And if you step back and think about it, you probably have a rule in your head that says, I never kick policemen in the tushy, right? You didn't have to consciously and purposely develop that rule, but you don't kick policemen in the tush, do you?
No, not usually.
Or
just that one time. No.
That you don't go 90 miles an hour in a 50 mile an hour zone.
Correct.
Or, that you speak politely to older people. We have all these rules of character without knowing it. And what I've discovered is that when it comes to food, because of the enormity of force that's aligned against us in the food industry, in the advertising industry, and even in the addiction treatment industry, we need to step back and actively think through what kind of people we want to become with regards to the foods that are troubling us. So I tell people to step back and think, what's the single most troublesome food or food trigger or eating behavior that's dogging you? For some people, it's an actual food. Like for me, it was chocolate, and I had to make rules about chocolate.
Mm-hmm.
For some people, it's an eating behavior, like eating while you're standing up or eating in front of your television or eating in front of your computer. And so you can make a rule that says, I'll never eat in front of the television again. Or for some people, it's eating too quickly, and so they can make a rule that says, I'll always put my fork down between bites. But what's your single most troublesome eating behavior or food trigger? And knowing that, what rule could you make, the simplest rule that you could make, that would make a big difference that you'd be willing to follow? And if you start with that one piece of practical advice and really say to yourself, well, you know, I'm just not the kind of person who eats while I'm standing up anymore. It's just not who I am. I'm the kind of person who eats sitting down. And you start to say that to yourself and you listen for that little voice that tries to argue you out of it, you're going to eliminate the need for exercising so much willpower, and you take so much of your power back. So that's what I mean by character trumps willpower, and that's what you can do with it.
Yeah, and by just starting with one simple shift, practice, and then having success with that, then, you know, if you have multiple food items or categories that you want to deal with, then you can, at least you can work from success then and feel, you know, feel empowered to be able to do that.
Yeah. Exactly.
So now you talk about, you know, identifying foods or food practices, eating practices that may be troublesome. So how does that fit into coming up with a food plan? What in your book, you talk about a food plan. You have a great chapter on that. So, but for the listeners, what kind of, you know, what is a food plan in your perspective, and how does one go about setting it up?
A food plan is the set of food rules, and it's the minimum set of food rules that protects you and makes you feel like you can accomplish your health and fitness goals. Protects you from binging and makes you feel like you can accomplish your health and fitness goals. And I usually suggest that people start out very simply. And as a matter of fact, at the end of the call, I'll tell you where people can get a set of examples for any dietary philosophy, whether it's ketogenic or macrobiotic or point counting or calorie counting, whatever you do. There's a set of starter templates for you. But usually it's better to start with one rule so people don't get overwhelmed. And there are four types of rules, at least that I've found. There are never rules, things that you'll never do again. And we can talk about why people are frightened of that word and why you don't have to be. There are always rules, things that you always do. Like I always start my day with 2 servings of fruit and vegetables, whole, fresh, ripe, or fruit and vegetables. There are things that you'll do only under certain conditions. Like I will only ever eat pretzels in a Major League Baseball park again. And then I like people to think through an unrestricted category. What are the things that you will eat without concern, just so that you know you're not going to starve, and when the pig says, hey, you're not going to have enough, you're going to starve if you do this, it doesn't seem like it makes any sense. So we have a couple of worksheets and things you can download for free to stimulate you to think of all the different possible things that might be difficult for you and where you might need to have some of these, you know, stoplights and stop signs and yield signs. And you don't want to restrict your freedom more than you have to, but you don't want to leave yourself in danger either. And you put that together into a food plan. And what you need to understand is that we present the food plan to the pig as if it were set in stone, even though it's not. So we'll say, I will never have chocolate on a Saturday again. And the reason we do that is the same reason that we say never to a two-year-old about dangerous things. So little Sarah, you can't ever cross the street by yourself without holding my hand. Never. But you and I both know that when Sarah is 9 or 10 years old, I will have taught her to look both ways and cross the street by herself. So why do we do that? Well, we do that because at 2 years old, it's too dangerous for Sarah to even consider darting out into the street by herself. We don't want those images running around in her head. We don't want those thoughts running around in her head. And because of that, we present it as if it's set in stone. She's not old enough and mature enough to consider that when she's 9 or 10 years old, she'll be able to do that. Because if she's thinking about them, then she's going to, you know, be excited and eager to do that. And then those ideas are going to be in her head and they're going to distract her and they might be dangerous. And our pigs act like two-year-olds around our troubled foods. So we say never, but you can change your food plan anytime you want to. I recommend that you do it with serious consideration. So you don't do it impulsively, but take an hour to step back and write out exactly what you want to change and why. And I recommend that you allow 24 to 48 hours to lapse before that change goes into effect. The reason being that if you don't, then the pig could change something that you want to eat right now and it becomes a more impulsive decision. But this way, it's a much more intellectual decision. So that's what I can tell you about food plans. It's a set of rules that you want to follow, informed by nutritionists and dietitians and gurus and things, diet gurus, but ultimately you're responsible for it.
Yeah, okay. And now when it comes to, you know, maybe deviating from that particular, you know, plan that you set up, you know, a lot of people beat themselves up. You know, I've been on my diet, dang it, I've been on this diet following this food plan for a week now, and all of a sudden, you know, that pig came out and it just squealed away, and I kind of went off target. When that kind of thing happens, isn't it important to kind of be gentle with yourself and not kind of go crazy with judgment?
So let's talk for a moment about the appropriate role of guilt or shame in the human psyche. So if you accidentally touch a hot stove, you want to feel pain for a second, right? You want to feel that physical pain for a second, because otherwise you won't know where the hot stove is so that you don't touch it again. And there are disorders in this world that children are born with the inability to feel pain, and we can't keep them alive more than 4 or 5 years. So pain serves a physical function. It's an important thing. But on the other hand, what you don't want to do is feel pain indefinitely or for too long after you touch the hot stove. You're entitled to pain relief. Once you have paid attention and you know that you're not going to do it again, there's no purpose for the pain to continue. And you don't want to put your whole hand down on the stove and say, damn it, I'm a compulsive hot stove toucher. I might as well get it over with. That's what you don't want to do. But that's what people do with food sometimes. The psychological function of guilt is to draw your attention where it needs to be so that you can analyze what went wrong, make any adjustments if you have to, and then stand up and aim at the target again. What that means is, was there something wrong with the rule that you were following? Were you unable to manage your blood sugar that day? Did you get too hungry? Did you not get enough sleep? Did you not eat enough earlier in the day? Or was it what we call a conscious pig party, where you heard the pig squealing and you decided to eat anyway? Or was there a loophole in the food rule? Was it not clear enough, and so the pig snuck through an exception? Once you've paid attention to that and fixed those things, you have to let go of the guilt and the shame. And it turns out, I actually just took a syndicated blogger's position for Psychology Today, and we have to do a lot of research before we publish something. And so I was researching this very point, and I found something really interesting. It turns out that feeling excessively guilty about a mistake that you've done with reading actually can decrease your metabolism, and decrease your ability to feel in control later on. And it can increase your perceived weight. When people feel guilty about what they ate, the person who feels guilty, even if they weigh the exact same thing as the person who doesn't, they think that they're fatter. So it's really, really interesting. The psychology of this is very important. And I've always said that the excessive guilt, the perseveration on guilt, the getting stuck on guilt after making a mistake, that's binge motivated in and of itself. What's happening is that the pig is trying to make you feel too weak to resist the next binge. It's saying you're a pathetic character. You don't have the ability to set rules and keep them. You failed 1,000 times before. You're always going to fail. So you might as well just give up and binge and be a happy, fat person. And turns out that that's a very, very dangerous voice. And what you want to do is forgive yourself with dignity. So you commit with perfection. When you're aiming towards a goal, you visualize yourself on top of the mountain, or you visualize the arrow hitting the bullseye, or you visualize yourself winning the race. And you do that so that you can purge your mind of doubt and distraction and focus all your energy on the goal. And there are some commitments for which nothing less than perfection will do. So that's why you don't hear marital vows saying, gee, honey, I'm pretty sure that I can avoid sleeping with other women, but, you know, there are a lot of attractive people out there. And I don't want to lie to you, progress, not perfection. There are some goals where perfection is required in the commitment. But when it comes to food, although perfection is required in the commitment, forgiveness is required after a mistake. And it sounds like that's contradictory, but it's really not. We are capable of shifting those mindsets before and afterwards. Stand up and aim at the archery target again. Forgive yourself with dignity. Commit with perfection, forgive with dignity.
Yeah, that makes sense. Excuse me, that makes sense. And you know, I think, you know, that forgive with dignity is an important piece. Now, since we're kind of talking about, you know, guilt and shame, along that same line, quite often people will have, there will be social pressures on an individual, you know, particularly if someone is obese. There's, you know, a lot of, you know, body shaming, you know, to a degree, you know, regarding the individual. So if someone is in that position and is attracting social pressure from, you know, social connections, what would you say to them regarding that situation?
You know, the danger is when they start to avoid the social situations entirely and their life gets smaller and smaller, and that tends to facilitate more isolation and binging. And so I would tell them that people don't care about your weight to the extent that you think that you do. They might say things sometimes, and, you know, people are cruel, but what really matters is what you think. And the moment that you turn the ship around, and it can take some time to turn the ship around, by the way, if you think about, I was on a large cruise to Mexico the other day, and it takes a while for those gigantic boats to, it's a bad metaphor, but for a big boat to, that's been going in one direction, to turn around and head in the other, in the other way. But the moment that it does, then, you know, you're going to get there. Like I have a client who started at about 500 pounds, and he lost over 200 pounds, 5 pounds a month, like 1 pound a week. And it's very, very difficult to lose 200 pounds. It's an enormous task to think about, but it's not an enormous task to think about losing 1 pound 200 times. So take a step in the right direction. Focus on what you think about yourself. Yes, we have a problem in our culture. Yes, people are cruel to overweight people, to large size people. Yes, the body image of the ideal woman especially is much smaller than it really necessarily should be. And, you know, I think that we can do some work to eradicate that notion. But by the same token, I don't want to help people to accept an unhealthy weight for themselves. There's a movement to suggest that it can actually be healthy to be heavy, and maybe in some cases that's true, but I think in large part it's not from the science that I've seen. And so I'm a little worried about people, the idea of giving up and being a happy fat person. It would be okay with me if it was just about looks, but I don't think it's just about looks. I really do think it's about health, and
yeah.
I think that's dangerous.
Yeah, there is that health component that just increases risk, you know, in many ways, you know, with, you know, weight that is in excess of, you know, your frame and now, if people wanted to start this tomorrow, would they be able to, or how would you say that someone, in addition to buying your book, you know, starting that food plan, how would they set this in motion? The idea of, you know, kind of wrestling that inner pig.
Well, first of all, you don't have to buy the book. You can get a Kindle Nook or PDF copy at everybodygan.com for free. If you want to. There are paperbacks and Audible that are a small charge. But to set this in motion, you just need one rule. What's your worst eating? What's your worst trigger food or eating behavior? Make one rule to control it and declare yourself 100% confident that you can, and declare that any other thought, feeling, or image whatsoever that suggests that you'll break this between now and the day that you die is your inner pig. You can call it your food demon. You don't have to call it a pig. You call whatever you want to, as long as it's not a cuddly pet.
Right. Right.
And do it. You know, do it. Read the book. Get to work. Pay attention, and you'll be surprised.
Yes. Now, you said that you were going to direct people to where they could get starter rules or tools. And what was that again? Where was that again?
Well, if you go to neverbingeagain.com, neverbingeagain.com,
okay,
and click the big red button, you'll get three things. You'll get a copy of the book in Kindle Nook or PDF format. You'll get a set of starter food plan templates, which are sets of rules that you can adjust for your own needs, for any dietary philosophy, high carb, low carb, point counting, calorie counting, whatever you want. Then I also recorded a set of coaching sessions, full coaching sessions, because I know this sounds really weird in principle, in theory. It sounds like I'm a crazy psychologist. You're probably thinking, how in the world did this guy have him on the show? This guy has a pig inside of him. You know, doesn't let farm animals tell him what to do, and what the hell is going on, that, excuse me, language. But it's not crazy philosophy and practice. It's a very compassionate, life-giving, hope-restoring, enthusiasm-restoring process. And I wanted you to hear that, so I recorded a whole bunch of coaching sessions, and you'll get those also. All you got to do is click the big red button on neverbingeagain.com and sign up for the free reader bonuses.
Great. Well, that's, you know, that's good. And now, with the holidays, you know, some people tend to go overboard, you know, during this particular season. Is there any, you know, I mean, outside of, you know, doing a food plan, is there any kind of tip, any ideas, you know, that you may want to share? Yeah.
If you think of the archery target metaphor again, there's the bullseye, but then there are the second and third rungs, or even the fourth rungs of the archery target, and each of those rungs have very clear boundaries. And so sometimes on the holidays or special occasions, people decide that they're not going to shoot for the bullseye, they're going to shoot for the second rung or the third rung. And rather than going in and succumbing to the enormous social pressure and temptation with all the, you know, once in a year foods that are available, what if you went in and you had a plan? And not everybody can do this. Some people, for example, can't have sugar or flour ever. And I don't recommend that they break for the holidays, but a lot of people can. What if you decided that you're going to have one plate of any food that you wanted to for dinner at Christmas, and one serving of dessert, and that's all you were going to do? And you had very clear boundaries, and you know when it began and end, and you wouldn't hit your bullseye, but you'd hit your second rung. what that does is it makes the decisions before you're in the face of enormous social pressure. And if you recall, decision-making wears down your willpower. Social pressure wears down your willpower. So a lot of times people who've historically had a lot of trouble on Christmas or New Year's or whatever the special occasion is, if they think it through beforehand and make a very specific plan that delineates where the beginning and end of that indulgence is going to be, then they do perfectly fine with it.
Okay, great. Well, Glenn, this has really been a joy speaking with you. I don't think you're one of those crazy psychologists talking about pigs squealing and all that kind of thing. I think you provide some very practical a different perspective, you know, and on things that's practical and people can use. And I really appreciate that.
Well, thanks, man. It was really nice to talk to you.
It's great. It's my pleasure, and a happy holidays to you and all of those 17 psychos in your realm.
You've okay. Come to my family reunion now. You're invited to my family reunion.
Okay, great. Beverly, now you're on social media?
Yeah, you can find all the links at neverbingeagain.com.
Great. Okay, so everyone join him on those.
I'll be happy to spread this. I will be happy to distribute this once it's available.
Great, thank you, and I'll be sure you get a copy, and I'm going to by the end of the show, or right after the end of the show, make sure that we link up on all those platforms because I really do want to keep in touch with you.
Very good. I look forward to that.
Great. Thank you. Again, everyone, today my very special guest has been Dr. Glenn Livingston, and we have been talking about his book, Never Binge, book and program, Never Binge Again, Reprogram Yourself to Think Like a Permanently Thin Person. Again, you can find out more by visiting his website, which is neverbingeagain.com, and definitely go there and click on that big red button and get those freebies and get yourself started on your own food starter, your starter food template, and all of the things that he offers through that link. So, everyone, I want to thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. And until we meet again, thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Be sure to visit our website at www.biteradio.me. That's biteradio.me. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Byte Radio Me, and our shows are also available as a free podcast from iTunes. And until we meet again, remember to be a bright light by bringing inspiration to your world and to the lives of those you touch.